From NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here's your host, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Can I say off the top, it's a little weird not to have any applause. Carl, would you mind clapping a bit?
Yeah.
Thank you. I feel so much better. We're back in the studio this week just by ourselves. Why? Because much like an unexamined life isn't worth living, an unexamined radio show isn't worth showing. So, in honor of our 10th anniversary on the air, we at Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me thought it would be a good thing to gather the gang and see what they think of when they think of the best moments, or at least the most memorable moments of our show so far. And Carl, of course, we are going to start with you. So, Carl, you've been doing this show from the beginning. Has it affected your credibility as a newsman?
Peter, way back at the beginning of the show,
yeah,
I had one woman come up to me in San Francisco and say, "You shouldn't do this. It takes away from your dignity as a newsman." But since then, it hasn't happened.
Really?
Even today, in Chicago or on the road, I'll have people come up to me and say, "You know, I've been listening to you for X number of years," or, "I've grown up with you in the morning listening to your newscast, and I love it. And it's great to see the other side of Carl Castle."
The other side of Carl Castle. If you ever write a memoir, Carl, that would be the title.
That's the title of my book.
All right, Carl, you've been with us from the beginning. What are some of the most memorable moments that you think about when you think about us?
Well, you know, the phone messages, I think, has had a big impact on me as well as the show itself. And one of them, I like to say that I think I enjoyed particularly, was having to do with Boogeyman.
Right. This was your singing debut, at least in terms of answering machines.
Exactly.
We have it here. Here is Carl Castle on an actual answering machine message playing right now somewhere in America.
Hello, this is Carl Castle of National Public Radio. You have reached the home of Leslie Bayer. Leslie regrets that she's unable to take your call right now, but she'll get back to you as soon as she can. But in the meantime, sit back, relax, and listen to these profound words. I'm your boogeyman. That's what I am. I'm here to do whatever I can, be it early morning, late afternoon, or midnight. It's never too soon. I'm your boogeyman. 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 Boogeyman.
Carl, William Shatner right now is shaking in his boots, afraid you're stealing his gig.
Now that could take away from my dignity and my credibility as a newsman.
All right, Carl, do you have anything else that you think about when you think about us?
Yeah, we were, I remember one time in New Haven, Connecticut, one thing that you created for me, as you created quite a few things for me to do on this program, it had to do with helium. I'd never done helium before.
Yes, I know. This was our idea.
It was a great new experience for me. We had the balloon. We had a balloon, two of them, as a matter of fact, filled up with helium.
Well, let's play it, and we can talk about it. We have it here. Now, it is true. This is how the Wait, Wait staff, my colleagues and I, we all introduced Carl Castle to controlled substances. This is from a show we did in New Haven, Connecticut, in September 2006. Kiri, this past week, the U.S. government announced that this country is in the midst of a severe shortage of what?
The U.S. government announced that we have a severe shortage of...
It's something the government would notice.
They would notice. A shortage of... Well, I know the deficit.
Right. Well, maybe Carl has a hint for you. Carl, do you have a hint?
No, Peter, I don't.
Oh, man.
Say from NPR, this is Carl Castle with NPR News. Try it.
I'm Carl Castle, NPR News.
I talked that way for 2 days, I think.
The really sad thing, though, Carl, was Carl sadly became addicted to sucking on helium. We found him a couple days later mugging birthday party clowns to get their balloons. It was terrifying. Carl, before we let you go, we want to play one other thing. This actually was the way that Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, your second home at NPR, celebrated your 30th anniversary on the air. It was in April 2007. It's how we began that week's show at the Chase Bank Auditorium. Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you so much. We have got a great show for you today. Presidential candidate and Congressman Dennis Kucinich will join us later to play Not My Job. But first, in May 1977,
A baritone-voiced newsman named Carl Castle came to work at a small broadcasting outfit that most people assumed was some kind of government agency. For 20 years at NPR, he represented the highest standard of serious news reporting. And then, about 10 years ago, he started doing comedy on the side. So it's only fitting that this week, Carl Castle's 30th anniversary at NPR, he finally found a way to combine his two skills, as he did during the morning newscast on Tuesday.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carl Castle. Former Justice Department White House liaison Monica Goodling is testifying.
Brilliant, Carl.
I knew from the get-go I was going to do that.
But remember, you can get that sure-footed voice on your own home answering machine.
So, Carl, I got to ask you, after 10 years of doing our show, you're not tempted in the morning sometimes when you're doing the news, instead of, say, introducing a clip of a newsmaker, to just imitate their voice yourself?
No.
Well, Carl, here's to a fabulous 10 years working together, and here's hoping for another 10 good ones.
Well, thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Carl. This week, we are strolling down memory lane hand-in-hand with our panelists as we discover or rediscover some of the highlights of the first 10 years of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Joining us now, of course, one of our original panelists, Roxanne Roberts from Washington, D.C. Hey, Rox.
Hey, but we haven't aged a day, right?
No, I think you are even more beautiful than you are. Than
I was
you were.
Not fishing for compliments
and
there.
And yet you landed one. So, Rox, as you know, we asked everybody to come up with some of their favorite moments. You actually mentioned a moment from our very first show in front of a live audience that we did in January 2000, right?
Yes. Yes, it was us being dirty without being dirty.
Yes, exactly. Which
one
is
one of our trademarks.
Which is a skill we have. So let's go back to January 2000. We're in front of a live audience, our first ever, in Salt Lake City in an auditorium at Westminster College in that town. Roy Blunt, if a law now under consideration in the Mississippi State Senate passes, men will be arrested and fined for being what in public?
I remember this exact phrase, in fact. Discernibly turgid.
Yes. The man doesn't know you eat melted butter with lobster, but this. He's all over. Yes, that's right. The answer is sexually aroused.
No, it's discernibly turgid.
Well, you know.
Oh, is that what that means? No. Boy, am I embarrassed.
The law is intended to restrain lap dancing and the like at strip clubs. It expands the definition of public nudity to include, and I am now quoting from legislative language, the showing of covered male genitals in a discernibly turgid state.
Peter, I occasionally ask this question. Why did we fight the Civil War? What was the whole point?
I do want to point out that the turgid state does not refer to Mississippi. That's... That's why we have to exist, Roxanne, because no one else in public radio would talk about that.
Well, you know, I mean, it leads to all sorts of questions, but one of the things that I think that we do really well is that there's lots of dirty stuff out there, and there's also a lot of silly dirty stuff out there, and we're able to somehow talk about it in a way that allows the children to still be in the room?
Yes. We're sort of nodding and winking and nudging to America. That's our role.
Exactly. Exactly. But basically, we're being ladylike about it.
Speaking of, shall we say, love and romance.
Yes.
Another thing you mentioned was a show that we did more recently where we talked about that topic.
Oh, this is the mice.
The mice, the
this
famous
mice.
This
is the mice. Fact that, you know, of course, I've always had an affection for mice anyway. I think they're cute. But... it turns out that scientists discovered that when mice are in love, they sing to each other.
You're right. Let's hear our discussion of it from November of 2005. Roy, scientists studying the mating habits of mice made a remarkable discovery this week. When a male mouse catches the scent of a female, what does it do?
I'll be loving you always. You really can't hear it that well.
I know.
It's very high.
That's right. It sings very
it
well.
Sings,
done.
Yes.
We thought only that bats, whales, and humans sang to communicate, although, of course, a lot of humans probably should not bother. As for their mice, it turns out their songs are sung at really high frequencies and therefore inaudible to humans. Scientists, however, were able to use some translation technology to create a recording of the mice that we can hear.
We should just keep going with this.
Ah, oh, Roxanne, I begin to get a sense of your preferences here.
Well, the idea of, a mouse singing "Let's Get It On," I mean, it really doesn't get a lot better than that.
It really doesn't. Roxanne Roberts, always great to talk to you, and we'll look forward to having another fabulous 10 years in the air.
Oh, I hope so.
Bye-bye, Rox.
Bye.
Coming up, it's Tom Baudet and Paula Poundstone.
From NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here again is your host, Peter Sagal.
Thanks, Carl. Today on Wait, Wait, it's sort of the radio equivalent of Nick at Night. Instead of original programming, we are returning to the archives for some highlights from yesteryear. And in fact, as our guide, we're asking our panelists to tell us what they think are some of our most memorable moments. Joining us now from his home in Vermont, Tom Baudet. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Well, Tom, we asked you, of course, to come up with some of your favorite moments from the show, at least since you joined us a few years ago. One of the things you came up with was actually involving another panelist, P.J. O'Rourke.
Oh, yeah. I love having P.J. on the panel when he's there. We have so much fun Republican bashing that we forget that sometimes there's Republicans in the room. And I remember when we were having the interview with Elizabeth Edwards, she made a particularly pithy remark, and PJ sort of leapt to the defense of Republicans everywhere, and I just loved the way she handled that.
Well, it's interesting is that it's not so much Republicans. She actually kind of hit him even closer to where he lives. This is from June 2007. Mrs. Edwards joined us to play our Not My Job game, and the subject of her quiz was about celebrity rehab centers, and now she's on her final question. Here we go. We take you now to what Blender magazine describes as the rehab of last resort. The place you go where everything else has failed. Which is what? A. Them Krabok Monastery in Thailand, where Buddhist monks force patients to drink an herbal medicine which induces projectile vomiting. B. Rough Rider Hunters Camp and Sobriety Center in Darby, Montana, where you have to stay sober because you won't eat if you can't shoot straight. Or C. The Center of Higher Consciousness in Miami, Florida, where Jackie Stallone, Sly's mother and a well-known psychic, lectures you every day for 6 hours about the right way of living.
Ooh.
I have to say, that last one sounds like the place of last resort.
You think so? You know you've hit bottom where you're throwing yourself upon the mercy of Jackie Stallone.
For 6 straight hours.
Yeah.
Now. Yeah. Ooh. So we have Thailand, which I'm thinking is not it.
Them Krabok Monastery in Thailand.
Yeah. I just can't see the handing a bunch of drunks guns.
Wait a minute.
That's the platform of the Republican Party right there.
They had stayed perfectly nonpartisan. I try to save my political venom for an actual election year, right? And then I think spend it in 2007. But when you're talking about drunks with guns, cutting pretty close to the knuckle there.
Listen, I have my medals from my years taking riflery at military bases. So
yeah, that scares me and a wife. My wife happens to be a pretty good shot, too. And it's just, yeah. I find that just terrifying.
Yeah. Like you say, you can make fun of Republicans all you want when PJ is around. He's a good sport. Make fun of drunks with guns, though, and he shall respond. Fortunately, it wasn't our
time.
It's
even funnier than I remember.
Yeah. You also mentioned in your list of things that you liked a story involving Roy, which it turns out is not uncommon among you panelists. We found out this hour that a lot of you guys have fond memories of Roy's contributions to the show. What was this one?
Well, I think, you know, what Roy's tremendous talent is how he'll lay back in one of these panelist exchanges, and you think he has nothing to say, but he has more to say than the rest of us put together most of the time, and he's just waiting his turn. And one of my favorite dissertations of Roy's involved his nostalgia for the old wing mirrors that used to come on cars and pickups. I think they stopped doing that sometime in the 70s, but every time now I do one of these projectile, if you'll forgive me, expectorations out of my truck window, I think of Roy, and I mean that in the most heartfelt way.
Roy, a woman in Kansas City, Missouri, who just wanted to spit while driving, accidentally did what?
Oh, God. I don't... She just wanted to spit, and she actually thought better of it and sang a little hymn out the window. Because she thought, if I spit, it will get on the radio. And I don't think people should hear words like spit on the radio. So blessed assurance was what she sang. I don't see there's any silver lining in this at all. She stuck her head out and she ran over someone's kitten. Some little child's kitten was out there. And just because this lady had to spit, I think it was a little black and white kitten.
Oh, I'm so depressed.
Oh.
Well, she opened the door to do it.
Oh, she opened the door and fell out.
Right.
She fell
out.
God. Oh, what a relief. She opened it. Why did she open the door to spit? That's not what...
I don't know.
They used to have those little triangular vents.
So yeah.
Then you could spit, but now without that vent, it's back in your face.
Anyway, she decided she needed to spit. She was rolling down Highway 71. She opened her door, leaned out, and rolled onto the pavement.
Ah.
And then ended up chasing her car down the road.
Ah.
Come back!
Where was the kitten?
You know,
that was a lot less about the wing mirrors or the wing windows than I remembered.
It's okay. I was just about to say, without Roy around, the rest of us would have to think of a lot more things to say. So I'm grateful for him. You had one more that you mentioned, and it was a part of the genre of stories that we refer to around the office as the dumb criminal stories. Although it was a particularly good one.
Oh yeah, this was a robbery that was foiled by the fact that one of the gang brought a duck. I think that was the premise, and Adam and I were on the panel, and I think Kiri as well, and Adam is wont to do, just ran with this this idea of a well-planned bank robbery gone wrong by a duck.
A shoplifter trying to make a clean getaway from Seattle Linens and Things was foiled when his girlfriend blanked.
Told him he'd snatched the wrong colored towels.
No. Dropped her pet duck.
You know, when I'm going to do a caper.
Yeah. Well, here's a warning to all
you. How many times
criminals.
Did I tell her before we did this job? We rehearsed it time and time again. Yeah. Don't drop the duck, I said. just hold. All you got to do is hold on to the duck, and it's worked.
the
Jeez, I can't believe it.
I mean, at least the lady in Gaza at least strapped the alligators on. You think you could belt the duck to you, and then you know, it'd be like a hands-free sort of thing. Then.
Next time I knock over a linen store, no ducks! In retrospect, that was the most deeply flawed part of our plan.
The Seattle man robbed the store while his girlfriend and her duck peepers shopped at the Petco next door, you see. When the girlfriend dropped peepers in the parking lot during the getaway, helpful Petco employees rushed to peepers' assistance. They caused a chain reaction of crashes and accidents. They completely fouled up the heist.
Nice.
That, you know, I'm often just reduced to stumbling, stuttering, and guffawing when I'm on the panel with Adam.
The great thing about Adam is the rest of us are just wondering, what were they thinking? And Adam seems to actually know somehow. Tom Beaudet, we're so glad you could join us. It's been great to have you with us the last few years, and we hope for many years more.
Oh, thank you very much, Peter. Sure enjoy doing it.
Bye-bye, Tom.
Bye now.
This week we are taking a break from sitting around and just telling ourselves how wonderful we are. We're having our panelists join us to have them tell us how wonderful we are. And joining us now from her home, Paula Poundstone. Hey, Paula.
Hey, Peter.
How are you?
I'm basking in the reflections.
That's good. So I want to ask you, Paula, before we ask you about your moments, has being on Wait Wait for a good 7 years now, has it changed you in any way?
It has to. It's put a bounce in my step, I'll tell you that.
Really?
Yeah, it's actually one of my favorite things that I've ever done. It's a little bit like being, I would think, being a batter in a batter's cage. I try to keep up with what's going on in the world and with varying degrees of success, of course. But on Wait Wait, you know, people ask you questions about it for which I'm largely unprepared. And, you know, in the right moment, I can't make this promise all the time, as you well know, but... You know, in the right moment, it's so much fun to do.
It is. Well, and sometimes, as you say, sometimes you just take that mighty swing and you connect.
You know, there are times. And then there's those other times where you get that disappointing titch and it goes foul.
Yes.
And there's those other times where I remember once when I took my kids to the batting cages and I explained to them that you can't stand in front of where is the ball aiming. And at one point I did and just got... big, huge, grizzly bruise on my thigh, and I feel like I've also had that experience on Wait Wait. So,
well, thinking back on it, the last few years, what are some of your memorable moments on the show?
Well, you know, I'm not so good with the memory thing, by the way.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah, I understand we're taking a risk, but
it's a big problem being the memory thing. Well, I love, this is kind of random, but I love it when Carl does who's called this time, and it's a woman.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even necessarily have a female-specific character. I find all of them, you know, equally skilled, and where if I wasn't looking right at him, I'd have thought she was in the room with me.
I can only agree. To prove the point, we actually have some tape of Carl doing an amazing array of female characters, and I think you'll be able to really sense the characterizations, not just the tonal qualities of the voice, but the heart and soul of the character. Here, for example, is Carl doing Paris Hilton.
I have a new outlook on life. Don't serve the time. Let the time serve you.
I mean, you can the blondness of it. You know what I mean?
And you can tell he did his homework on that one.
Now here, just listen to the contrast. Listen to how, using the same vocal equipment, he's able to create an entirely different persona, as here he does Britney Spears talking about the impending birth of her first child.
My mom said giving birth was the most excruciating thing she's ever gone through in her life. So if a cesarean doesn't happen, I'd be like, epidural, please.
I can see the preparation. I can see the actor's preparation that went into each one. I noticed from talking to Carl that he sat in a jail cell with a purse to prepare for the Paris Hilton one. And
it's like Robert De Niro preparing for Raging Bull. It's crazy.
Very, very much.
Very much like that.
Yeah, he gained weight for the Britney Spears one.
Paula, do you have any highlights from your personal highlight reel?
Well, my personal highlight, you know, I got to be a part of the conversation of talking with Justice Stephen Breyer, who was on the show, and that's, you know, that was very exciting. It really made me feel like I was way up there. You know, it's the highest court in the land, the Supreme Court, and so I asked about where he got his robes.
Yeah,
well, which is, I think, the kind of thing that most Americans would ask if they had the chance.
And thanks to you, we got the answer. Here it is. This is from our visit with Associate Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer in March of 2007. Do people treat you a bit, shall we say, formally, because you are, of course, Justice of the Supreme Court?
Many do. Right. Some don't.
Does it bother you?
My family doesn't.
I'm sure
which
not.
Which do you prefer?
Which do I prefer?
Yeah.
No, I prefer not formal. I prefer not formal.
That's why we're just kind of getting down with you.
Yeah. That's why we're bringing up the sausages. Yeah. Do you have like a ritual in which you say, hey, I don my robe one voluminous head hole at a time, like anybody else? I mean, is there some? Do you find yourself? What would you say? Do you find yourself, you know, having to put people at ease because you are a justice of the Supreme Court?
Sometimes, but I wouldn't do it that particular way.
All right, now you have one.
Wait, I have to say, now that you mentioned the robe, this has been eating away at me.
Yeah.
I happen to have OCD. Do you lint lift?
What? Sorry?
Your robe, the black robes, do they get fuzz on them?
The question for you, Justice Breyer, is do you ever have to maintain your robes with an adhesive and or other kind of lint removal device?
Or does Justice Alito pick it off for you?
You know, actually, I bought my robe, I think, about 25 years ago when I in Boston.
Where did you buy your own robe? Where do you go for it?
I went to some shop down, I remember, down
get
it was downtown, and then I was. It's a very,
great.
What? It's a synthetic.
Robes are us.
You've been great up until now, and I've so trusted you, and I thought we're in good hands. But there's no. You bought your robe in downtown Boston?
Yeah.
Where?
I can't remember the name of the place.
He's not allowed to. No.
It's a synthetic.
It's a synthetic robe, you're saying.
Yeah. Is it synthetic? What,
yeah, it has no lint.
Oh, that's great.
The nicer robe was Justice O'Connor's and Justice. Ginsburg.
Oh, what do they have? Is it lined?
They're very nice.
No, the synthetics are nice because they wick the sweat during intense arguments.
Ooh,
but how did
technical fabric?
First of all, I would have thought that got provided.
Yeah. No.
No, they don't. No,
it's like working at the IHOP, for heaven's sakes.
You know. No, Paula, I shared your amazement. Why was it so amazing that Justice Breyer and presumably the other Supreme Court justices have to buy their own robes?
Wouldn't you think that's something that, you know, when you go to the Supreme Court, they provide, if for no other reason than just the homogenous quality of, you know, so that everybody has the same robe. Wouldn't you think that was part of the ceremony of getting there, is like that there's a special robe that you now wear?
Exactly.
Not just any old thing you drag out of your closet. Like, normally you'd have your hair cut with this, but now you're making constitutional decisions. Doesn't that seem odd to anybody else?
I guess it does. I mean, I guess professional baseball players, you know, they get their uniforms hung neatly in their lockers when they show up for work. They don't have to provide their own, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know what? Now that I was listening to that, I realized I missed the mark on what one of my favorite things is.
What?
One of my favorite things is when you go, all right.
Calm down now, kids.
Yeah, because you're stuck telling us to shut up so often. And just, you know, you have to go, you know, you have to do good cop and bad cop all the time.
Yeah, and good cop doesn't work with you guys.
No, and putting you in that position is really one of the joys of my life.
Hey, I'm going to pull this show over unless you people start behaving. Paula Poundstone, what a pleasure to have you on our show. And we'll have you back again soon as we go into the next 10 years.
Well, thanks so much, Peter.
Thank you, Paula. Bye-bye.
From NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here again is your host, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. This week, of course, it's a panelist-led tour through some of the highlights, or depending on your point of view, lowlights, of the last few years on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Joining us now from her outpost in Houston, Texas, Ms. Kiri O'Connor. Hey, Kiri, how are you?
Good, thanks, Peter.
Kiri, we have asking everybody to name some of their favorite moments, or at least most memorable moments from the last few years. You picked actually an appearance by a Not My Job guest, namely Al Michaels.
Yes, sports fan that I am. I did. I picked Al Michaels' Not My Job, which was, you know, remarkable for its, not only his performance, but, you know, that hallmark pure Al humor that is, you know, one of the mainstays of Wait, Wait.
Now, Al Michaels joined us during a short break from his broadcast of the NBA playoffs in the early summer of 2006.
And now the game where we ask people to come in and answer questions about things they know nothing about. It's a game we call Not My Job. Speaking of games, nobody on the planet knows more about them than Al Michaels of ABC Sports. He's the guy, of course, who shouted, "Do you believe in miracles?" when the U.S. hockey team beat the Soviets at the 1980 Olympics. And since then, he's broadcast every big game there is, from the World Series to, of course, Monday Night Football, where he's done the play-by-play for 19 seasons. Currently, he is broadcasting the NBA playoffs. But since there's no game in the tube, he agreed to join us. Al Michaels, welcome to Wait, Wait.
Great to be here, Peter.
I'm amazed that you do so many different sports. You do the football, of course, on Monday nights. You do the NBA now. You've done baseball. You've done the World Series. Do you ever have trouble keeping them straight?
Not really, but it's a case of just, you know, growing up and loving every sport as a kid. Of course, you know, now in today's environment, you need to be more expert than ever in each individual sport. For instance, when I started at ABC, almost 30 years ago, they assigned me to a lot of auto racing. And I probably have done in my career, you know, 50 to 60 NASCAR races and IndyCar races. And I've even done the Grand Prix of Monaco four times. But I haven't done a race in some 20, maybe 4 or 5 years, and probably won't again, so I can let the cat out of the bag. I don't even know how to go to self-serve. I don't know a gasket from a carburetor, and here I am having done 60 auto races in the 1970s. You could get away with it then, but not now.
Well, actually, I wanted to ask you about that. That's a good example, because...
But you can tell if something's going around and around,
exactly.
Can't you?
I was very good at that. I was very good at figuring out who was in what spot, and that's about it.
Yeah. Oh, I don't think you have to know how the car works to go, ooh, that one's faster.
Well, you need a good analyst, and thank God I had a guy like Jackie Stewart, who was a multiple world champion, to do things like that. The great thing, Paula, about this business is you have to know where you can go, and don't go any farther than you need to go.
Now, there was one time, of course, where you went very quickly from being a sportscaster to basically a newsman, and that was, of course, during the 1989 World Series.
When we had the earthquake in San Francisco.
You were sitting there. You were getting ready to do the game.
5:04, yeah. We had just come on the air. We were actually in our pregame show. And I was with Tim McCarver and Jim Palmer. I was introducing Tim, and Tim was voicing over a piece of tape when all of a sudden it struck. And I, you know, having lived in California a lot of my life, I knew immediately what it was. And
so you got the prime space under the
desk. Fortunately, it only lasted about 15 seconds, Peter. That was the amazing thing. I mean, normally those quakes last longer, big quakes. But this one shook for 15 seconds. And the irony was that most of the people in Candlestick Park, and by that point, at least 50,000 people in the ballpark that held close to 60,000, they didn't know the severity of the quake. So they're chanting, "Play ball, play ball." you know, people are making jokes about, you know, the quake was, we heard it's a 6.0, but the East German judge only gave it a 3.6, and that sort of stuff. But then, you know, the word began to filter back within, I'd say 20 minutes, that there was a section of the Bay Bridge had collapsed. There was a major fire in the Marina District of San Francisco. There was a pancake freeway in the East Bay. And then we all knew that, you know, this was a tragedy of major proportions, and it was 10 days before the World Series resumed.
And you were like doing ABC News reports from the scene.
I had to, because in the late 80s, yeah, you're going to bring out your people from New York, and Peter Jennings was on a plane the next morning and all of that, but I was the guy on the scene.
Yeah.
And we had one tremendous benefit that we had over the competition that night was the fact that we had the blimp in place, because we had the blimp ready to go to work during the ball game. So I was able to see a lot with my own eyes.
And, of course, in that instance, another advantage, you were easy to pick out in the rubble because of your bright yellow blazers.
That's true. We'd already got a blue by that year.
Yeah.
Well, Al Michaels, it is a pleasure to have you with us. Now, we have invited you here for once to play a game, and we're calling this game this week...
Those goats seem particularly frisky today.
According to legend, that's how coffee was invented, or discovered, rather. An Ethiopian goat herd noticed his flock becoming particularly jumpy after chewing the beans of a strange bush. We learned about the legend of the frisky goats from the book Uncommon Grounds, A History of Coffee, from Mark Pendergast. We have three questions for you about the beverage. Get three right. You'll win our prize for one of our listeners, a hot steaming cup of Carl Castle on their home answering machine. So, Carl, who is sportscaster Al Michaels playing for?
Peter, Al is playing for Lauren Damewood of St. Petersburg, Florida.
All right. You ready to play? You came to play?
I'm ready.
You got your game face on?
I don't want to disappoint Lauren. This would be terrible.
All right. Here's your first question.
The fresh is on.
Coffee was first cultivated by the Arabs and spread from them to the Turks. In fact, coffee was so important to the Ottoman Empire that what? A, the very highest class of courtesan accepted only coffee beans as payment. B, an insufficient supply of coffee was grounds, as it were, for a woman to divorce her husband. Or C, the Grand Sultan employed a high official whose only job was to make sure the coffee can was kept closed.
Can you repeat A for me again?
A, it was the very highest class of courtesan. I mean, the absolute primo babes of the Istanbul scene, if you were.
I just wanted to hear you say courtesan again. That's a great word. In fact, that may be a buzzword. During the NBA Finals, I don't know whether I'm going to get this right or wrong, Peter, but I'm going to use courtesan just for you in the finals.
Really? You're going to work that in?
Yeah, it'll be like, oh, it looks like...
But anyway.
It looks like O'Neal just had to have a courtesan shot in his
shoulder. I'm going for A.
You're going to go for A. Courtesans paid by coffee beans. No, I wish it was, because I have some coffee beans. It was B. It was an insufficient supply of coffee was grounds for divorce.
Oh, wow.
If
a man could not provide, could not bring home the Italian roast, goodbye to him.
I'm not sure that's changed.
Can't go 3 for 3 now.
No, you can't go 3 for 3. But you can still,
Guess you don't have your blimp helping you now, little buddy.
Here we go. Here's your second question. Coffee spread from the Turks to Western Europe, where it wasn't always received with good cheer. In France, doctors in the late 17th century called it a scourge of public health. Why? Was it A, it kept people from sleeping the recommended 4 hours a night? B, it prevented them from drinking the more healthful alternative, alcohol? Or C, it made people too twitchy to allow for easy bloodletting?
It has to be B.
It has to be B. It prevented them from drinking the more healthful alternative alcohol.
Correct.
You're right. Very good.
Yes.
Yes, and it counts.
A public letter from doctors in Marseille written in 1679 said, quote, "We note with horror that this beverage has tended almost completely to disaccustom people from the enjoyment of wine." All right, very good. Last question. During the same period, the 17th century, the coffee house became the center of culture and politics in London. Naturally, the British coffee houses inspired some opposition from whom? A, a group of women not allowed in coffee houses who claimed that the drink made their men impotent. B, Puritan leaders who said that quicker thinking led to more sinful thoughts per day. Or C, the Royal Guild of British Mead Makers.
My first thought is that B's a little whimsical, but I'm not throwing it out yet. A is like women's, it's like suffrage, right, in the coffee world.
Not exactly. That wasn't their complaint, but, I mean, that may have been their cause for concern, but their specific complaint was different.
Give me C one more time,
C Peter. Was the Royal Guild of British Mead Makers. Mead, of course, being the honey-based alcoholic beverage. One of these groups objected quite stridently to the coffee houses.
No, that's a set-up answer. A, it's got to be A.
You're right, sir.
A.
Oh, yeah! It's good!
A group of anonymous women published a petition against coffee, a pamphlet, in 1674, which said of British men, quote, "They come from coffee houses with nothing moist but their snotty noses, Nothing stiff but their joints, nor standing but their ears.
You know what? I'm going to use all of that during the interview.
That's explaining the rise of Starbucks and Viagra at the same time.
Carl, how did Al Michaels do?
The miracle happened again, Peter. Al had two correct answers. He wins our prize for Lauren Damewood. Congratulations, Al.
Thank you. And to Lauren, this is phenomenal.
So, Carrie, you were a little charmed by him, it seems. Is this not true?
Oh, this is absolutely true. Who wouldn't be charmed by Al Michaels and, you know, his love of the word courtesan?
I know. It was great. One thing I don't know is I don't know, and in fact, I doubt that he followed through in his promise to use that word.
Well, it was the NBA, so you know at least he used the word court.
That's true. And then he may just have muttered the... And now on the court, and thought he had fulfilled his promise. Because
yeah.
He's an honorable man. Carrie O'Connor, it's so great having you on the show, and we look forward to many more years with you.
Well, thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Carrie. This week we are indulging in a little navel-gazing, and we are doing it with the help of our panelists. Right now, I want to welcome one of our original panelists. He has been with us for the entire 10 years of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Charlie Pierce, how are you doing today?
If I try to do this gazing at my navel, you're not going to be able to hear me.
That's true.
I'm doing it right now, and this isn't going to work.
No, lift up your head and speak clearly, Charlie.
Okay, can I gaze at someone else's navel?
If you can get someone to come into where you are and have a navel to gaze at, if that helps you, really. Anyway, Charlie, we asked you, of course, to mention some of the things you remember best or most from our past. And one of the things you came up with was something we're particularly proud of, because usually we just make fun of the news. On one occasion, at least, we made it. When we actually broke a story, we were so proud. A little enterprise journalism from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. This is from the fall of 2006. Here we go. Paula, everybody knows, of course, Senator Barack Obama, very popular all around the country, but Nick Lovelady, a reporter for the Henry Daily Herald in Henry County, Georgia, really does not like him. He says that Senator Obama personally and maliciously prevented him from doing what?
Oh, my heavens. Urinating on the sidewalk.
People named Lovelady don't urinate on the sidewalk.
Although, interestingly, his name has an ironic relation to the story. He sort of prevented it from living up to his name.
Uh-huh. Oh, from dating someone in particular?
Yes. He says that Senator Barack Obama prevented him from scoring with a cute chick.
Oh, no.
Let me explain. The somewhat ironically named Lovelady says he was trying to impress an attractive female news intern. And he was doing a pretty good job of it, if he says so himself, when he arose to ask Obama a question at a press conference. But Obama mistook him for a student journalist and then explained, quote, "You have such a baby face." Mm. Everybody laughed, including the intern, and that was the last that Lovelady ever saw of her. That's the sad part. That's the sad part. But this is the amazing part. And this is a Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me exclusive. Must credit Wait, Wait, as Drudge likes to say. What you're about to hear is actual tape of U.S. Senator Barack Obama, Democrat of Illinois, reaching out to the reporter in question.
Lovelady newsroom.
Is this Nicholas?
This is he.
Nicholas, this is Barack Obama.
Hey, how's it going?
Man, I'm calling to publicly apologize for messing up your game. You know, I read that. I felt terrible. I didn't know there were any ladies around.
I
just wanted to let you know that, I'm deeply sorry. But if she was that superficial, she wasn't.
All right. I really appreciate it.
Hey, okay, man.
All right, thanks.
All right, bye-bye.
There you go. So Charlie, it's hard not to be charmed by a man who would do that.
This is an interesting one, because this is one I came to as a listener.
Yes.
And I had a wonderful Scooby-Doo moment at the steering wheel of my car when I heard that. And it wasn't so much that Obama had done it, because he was on the show before, and we all know once this presidential thing doesn't work out, he's going to be a panelist.
Right.
But the phrase, messing up your game. from the rising star of the United States Senate was enough to get me off the road.
Now, next on your list, Charlie, was a moment that we actually struck us as well when we were doing it. This was a show we did in New Hampshire in September of 07, and it wasn't so much what we did, it's what one of our listeners had to say when we got her on the phone. It's time to welcome our first listener contestant. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, my name is Pam. I'm from Beaver Creek, Ohio.
Hey, what's going on in Beaver Creek?
Not much. I'm actually right now kind of working.
Oh, but, I'm sorry. I mean, right now, even as we speak, what job are you doing?
I am an OBGYN, and I'm waiting for a delivery.
Oh!
But I didn't want to miss my chance to be on the show.
Does the expectant mother,
yeah.
is she right there? Can we talk to her and see how she feels about this?
She's in the room. I'm at the desk.
How far apart are the contractions now? I just wanted to see how long we have for the segment.
Oh, she's doing every 2 to 3 minutes.
Oh, let's get going, Peter.
Quickly, then. Well, we were concerned, obviously, about the fate, not so much of our listener who won, but for the poor woman and her baby. So we actually got in touch with the OBGYN. Here she is. So, Pam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Tell us, how is the baby?
Everybody did very well. Right. The baby did great, and mom did very, very well.
Did the mother ever find out where you had gone while she was in labor?
I did tell her, yes. Right after I had finished, I went in the room and told her.
And what was her reaction?
Since she was very comfortable with the epidural, she did think it was very funny.
She did. So she was like totally floating on cloud epidural and had no problem with it.
Exactly.
So presumably if you had come back and said, oh, I'm sorry, I just needed to bet on some horses, I was on the phone with my bookie, she would have been equally fine.
Probably.
Well, thanks. Congratulations to you and the baby, and congratulations again for winning our game.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, Pam.
Bye-bye.
Charlie Pierce, one of our original panelists. It's been a great 10 years. We hope for at least 10 more.
Well, I don't think the world's going to get smarter or less silly, so I think we're probably in great shape.
There'll never be a shortage of material. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Peter.
Bye-bye. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Judy and Steve Hopkins, supporting the Shakespeare Theater Company's production of Hamlet, starting May 22nd at Carter Barron Amphitheater in Washington, D.C. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and Chicago Public Radio in association with Urgent Haircut Productions' Doug Berman, executive producer. BJ Lederman composed our theme. Our program is directed by Melody Kramer and produced by Mike Danforth and Emily Ecton. The senior producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Rod Abid. Thanks to Carl Castle, Roxanne Roberts, Charlie Pierce, Tom Baudette, Paula Poundstone and Kerry O'Connor, and all of our panelists, and to all of you for listening. I'm Peter Sagal, and we'll see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.